I'm Don. I'm an alcoholic.
Don.
From where am I from? Bellingham, Washington. Okay. It's a funny thing about being from Bellingham. A lot of people get that wrong. It's Bellevue, and it's this, and it's that. I'll tell you a funny story about that. I was speaking in Florida a couple years ago, and I'll be honest with you, it was a tough trip. I had a lot going on in my life, but I had made the commitment, so I went out there, and I was at the Saturday morning speaker meeting, and the speaker went ahead and gave a nice talk, and I did what I've been taught to do. You get in line to go thank the speaker. So I'm standing there, and there's this young woman standing right behind me. She's looking at my tag, and they had misprinted my tag, and it had said Birmingham, Washington. And she looked at it, and she goes, "That's funny, Birmingham. I don't know where Birmingham is. I know where Bellingham is, though." And I go, "Well, funny thing, I'm from Bellingham." And she goes, "Oh, do you know Tommy J?" And I said, "Tommy J is one of my best friends. We go to meetings together. He's a great AA member." And she burst into tears. And I thought, "What, wrong answer?" And I said, "Well, why is it so upsetting?" She goes, well, Tommy J is my father. And we've been estranged for about 3 years. I've been in and out of the program forever. I shouldn't even be here. I live in Georgia now. I got about a year of sobriety, and my sponsor dragged me to this conference. I don't even want to be here. And I don't know how to call my father." And I said, "Well, I do." And I got my phone out, and I dialed Tommy's number. And I said, and he answered the phone and said, "Tommy, what's going on?" He goes, "Not much, buddy. What are you doing?" I go, "Somebody wants to say hi to you." And I handed the phone to this woman, and I hear, "Daddy?" And I got to tell you, you don't know why you do things in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have preconceived ideas of why we're going to our meetings, why we're giving people rides. And we always, in our head, why this is going to be purposeful. And we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen this weekend. I'm going to just try to, be open-minded and meet a lot of people and have a good AA experience, and that's all I ever look for. And I've never been let down in AA. From the day I got here, you guys have never let me down. I'm better when I'm with you. I'm happier when I'm with you. I feel safer when I'm with you. I feel like I'm with my people. I can talk about things in Alcoholics Anonymous, just sitting around the campfire, or sitting at a table, or having a cup of coffee. You can't talk about in polite society. You just can't. They will arrest you. And, and I want to thank the committee for inviting me, and my friend Allison for inviting me, and my new best friend Tab for picking me up at the airport on time and immediately getting me breakfast. I'm a simple guy. You can make me happy really easy by buying me breakfast, and he got that out of the way right away. So my new best friend Tab, and we've had a good time. We were together for a couple hours right off the bat this morning, and we're a couple of AA guys getting the truck, we're going off to breakfast, we're doing this and that, and we're talking about AA. And so, in a short 2 hours, I think we pretty much saved AA. I think we fixed everything that's wrong with it. We might need some follow-up conversations, but I always love that. It doesn't matter where you are. You meet people that are active in the program, and the same things are happening all over in AA, good and bad. We're all the same. Same disease, same recovery. And I like that. I like that I can be in a area like this. I was going to say room, but not really a room. I can be outside in the dirt and feel really comfortable because I'm with my people. And I haven't met you yet, but I know you're just like me. So thanks for the people that said hi to me, and thanks for all the kindness I've been shown. And that wonderful introduction that I won't live up to, but if you don't like it, blame Allison. So I'm off the hook. And I got to tell you, it's funny. I wasn't even thinking about this till a couple of days ago. It struck me. I was born and raised in Los Angeles. And, then I moved up to Bellingham, Washington in 2004. My sobriety date is September 16th, 1991. So I'm 26 years sober. And but my first drunk, believe it or not, was in Arizona. And I had completely forgotten that, And what it was is I was 13 years old. And I got picked to play in an all-star basketball team. And we were going to go represent the San Fernando Valley in the greater Los Angeles area at this nationwide tournament that was held in Phoenix. And we got on the plane at LAX, and they had mechanical difficulties, but they wouldn't let anybody off the plane. And the difficulties lasted so long that at first they sent all the other passengers off. And then the only people left on the were the flight crew and the attendants and the coaches and our team. And then finally, the attendants and the pilots, and everybody's off the plane now. It's just sitting on the tarmac. And they're saying, "Oh, no, we're leaving. They're just going to have to work on it." And finally, the coaches go, "Well, listen, it's going to be nuts. We got to go get off the plane, get something to eat. We're going to go grab something to eat really quickly, and then we're going to come back and grab all you guys, and we're going to take you out to lunch and get a quick bite while they work on the plane. And they left 12 13-year-olds alone on a 727. And very quickly, you got to find out who was who on that plane. Now, there were some of us that I would call, they were normal. And they weren't really moved by the experience. And they did things like they went in the galley and they helped themselves to a couple of bags of peanuts, and they did that. And then there was the Al-Anons, the future Al-Anons that were on that plane. And they sat in their seats going, we have to sit here. The coaches said to sit here. They said not to move. We have to sit here. Why aren't you sitting here? And then there were the alcoholics. And we didn't know anything about drinking. We're 13 years old. We're little athletes, right? We went in the galley. We weren't interested in peanuts. We weren't interested in crackers. We were interested in these funny little bottles of liquid that they had because we knew what those were. We knew they were valuable, and we knew we weren't supposed to mess with them, so we wanted them. And we grabbed all these little airplane liquor bottles and stuffed them in our socks and our gym bags and everything, and we got off the plane, and we hatched a plan. And that night, we were going, oh, man, the Al-Anons were losing their mind. The little you can't do that. You're going to get us all in trouble. We're going to get kicked off the team. They're not going to let us go. And we treated it in the spiritual way that alcoholics treat it. If you tell them, we'll kill you. And, you know. And we ended up in one of the guys' hotel rooms after lights out, and we drank all these little bottles. And we didn't know what we were doing, a little sip of this, a little sip of that. And we were so hungover the next day. We were so lucky to win our first game in that tournament. And I completely forgot that story, but I remember liking it. My first drunk, 13 years old, you know, and I didn't, you know, quit school and head to Skid Row and find myself a good corner to get busy at in the next 30 years. But I remember you have, it's imprinted in your memory. If you're an alcoholic, it's going to do something for you that it doesn't do for other people. And it did something for me that I didn't have the vocabulary to explain, but I have the vocabulary tonight. You know, in the doctor's opinion, it says that men and women drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. And, you know, alcoholics read that, and we go, duh, really? No kidding. But they're not talking about alcoholics. They're drinking. Men and women drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. But the alcoholic, what I didn't understand is the effect in my body is different than the effect in the normal person. And I can't know that because I only drink in my body. I didn't know that only 10% of the population has the reaction that I have to alcohol. That the other 90%, it's completely different. If you don't believe me, we've all got normal friends. We've all got normal drinkers. Ask them what happens when they drink. I've done it. It's crackers. I mean, I went up to a buddy of mine years ago and says, what's the effect that alcohol produces in you when you drink? And he thought it was a strange question, but he knew I was sober. And he said, well, you know, Donnie, sometimes I decide to have a drink. It's no big deal. Maybe I had a tough day at work. Maybe it's a celebration, and I have a cocktail. And I got to tell you, I drink the cocktail, and it's pleasurable. It produces a feeling in me, I don't know, relaxation. If there's music playing, I start to hear the beat a little bit. You know, I like it. And I usually have a second drink, you know, but somewhere in the middle of that second drink, I start to feel it. So I stop. No, you don't. It's about to get good, isn't it? You know, that's when you hit the accelerator. Let's go. You know, things are about to happen. It's 11 o'clock. You know, it's Tuesday night. People are going home. They're saying crazy stuff like, oh, look at the time. I have to work tomorrow. We don't understand that. As a class of people, we've always been willing to ruin tomorrow for a couple of more hours of fun tonight, you know? And we don't understand that people have a dip, that we're having an abnormal, an allergic reaction to alcohol. I remember when my wife, Eileen, she's sober 25 years, boy meets girl on AA campus, love her like good poetry. When we got engaged, when my older sister met my wife-to-be, she just fell in love with Eileen. She said, if you screw this up, I'll kill you. I mean, just fell in love with my wife-to-be. And they threw us a big engagement party, right? And there's some social drinker going on at this engagement party, what I call white wine drinking. You know what I mean? Not the kind of drinking we would do, but white wine drinking. And we're there, and there's a house full of people, and Eileen and I are sitting with my sister in the kitchen. My sister has a glass of wine. And at one point, she saw some people she wanted to go talk to, and she set her glass of wine down. And she left it and walked out in the living room. And Eileen noticed that. And Eileen is looking at the wine and looking at my sister getting further away and looking at the wine and looking at my sister getting further away. And at one point, she turns to me, and she goes, Pat left her wine. And I go, well, yes, she did. She goes, well, should I tell her? And I said, I said, baby, at this particular moment, she's not suffering from separation anxiety, you know. So the effect is different for us, and we don't even really think about the effect. You know, what's the effect? You know, is it I think I'm better looking than I am when I'm drunk? Yeah, maybe. I think I'm tougher than I am when I drink? Possibly. But that's not really the effect. You know, the effect for me, in a word, is relief. And relief from what? Relief from what swirls around in my head in a sober state. Because, you see, I don't know if I was born alcoholic. I don't know if I developed alcoholism. I don't get into that debate. But I know this. I was born weird. You know what I mean? Like half a bubble off a plum. There's something wrong with the boy. You know what I mean? Like, I'm that kind of guy. I've got all that alcoholic personality. I mean, I'm selfish. I'm self-centered. I'm self-obsessed. I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. I'm the kind of guy that gets you in a corner and traps you. And I'll talk for a half an hour straight about myself and then snap out of it, realize I'm doing that, and say, wait a minute, that's entirely enough about me. What do you think of me? And this type of self-obsession I'm born with. This isn't something that's a result of me drinking. This is something that reduces or magically even disappears with a couple of drinks inside me. You know, there's always been a wall between me and the rest of the world, and I felt it when I was growing up with that awkwardness. Like, people want to love me, people want to connect with me, and I want to love them, and I want to connect with them, but there's something not letting it get through. And I got to tell you, you put a couple of drinks inside a guy like me, and the wall comes down, and I get to come out and play. And I love the effect produced by alcohol. I fell in love with it when I was 13, and I chased that effect till I was 31, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love, alcohol held up his end of the bargain for the most point. Yeah, it almost destroyed my life. It almost killed me. It hurt everybody that had the misfortune of caring about a loser like me. But I got to tell you, small price to pay if it makes the madness in my head go away for a couple of hours. And that's hard to explain to the people that love me and care about me as my life begins to unravel over the years why I'm still drinking. And I love this, the doctor's opinion, because it really puts it in simple words why it's so important, because it tells me that I drink for that relief. I drink for the effect produced by alcohol. And it goes on to say that a guy like me, at a certain point in my drinking, after I have self-knowledge, after I know alcohol's a problem, I'll admit it's injurious. I admit it's killing me. I admit that it's hurting everyone around me. I know what's happened to me. I have a front row seat for the destruction of my life. But the sensation is so elusive. Nothing gets it for me like a couple of drinks. It doesn't matter who I date, how much money I make, what I accomplish in my life. Nothing gets it for me. Nothing fills the hole like a couple of drinks of alcohol. And so I admit it's killing me, but nothing gets it like that. And what happens is, because of the way that I drink and the consequences I suffer from, I will quit drinking on my own. I won't come to AA. I won't get a sponsor. I won't get a home group. I won't work steps. I will just quit drinking because I have billboard-sized information that says a guy like me shouldn't drink. So I will put the plug in the jug and I will make the alcoholic declaration that I'm quitting. Don't try to tempt me. And I will quit without AA for a week, for 2 weeks, for 3 weeks, even a month sometimes. And what will happen to me is described, and it's the biggest understatement in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the doctor's opinion. It says in very short order, I will find myself irritable, restless, and discontent. Doesn't sound half bad, does it? Sounds almost clinical, doesn't it? But that's not how it feels, does it? I'm irritable. I want to hurt you. I'm restless. I think I'll go over here. Nope, don't like them. Maybe I'll go over there. Nope, don't like them. Maybe I'll get some ice cream. God, I'm getting fat, you know? It doesn't matter what I'm doing, who I'm doing it with. It's the wrong thing at the wrong place with the wrong people. And I'm discontent. You know, it's funny, if when I came to AA, if you asked me what kills alcoholics, I would have said whiskey and car crashes with no hesitation. And today I say discontent. You know, before I drink again, I'm going to have to be discontent in Alcoholics Anonymous to leave a place like this. And I've seen it over and over again in AA. I've never seen anybody happy and purposeful in AA go out and drink, but I've seen a lot of guys sitting in the back of the room angry and AA with that vein pumping on their forehead, have to leave this place and go back to the grinder. Because that irritable, restless, and discontent nature, what it does, what alcoholism does better than anything for a guy like me, is it gives me a complete inability to experience joy in a sober state. You know what alcoholics like? We like when something's wrong. like something we can point to, you know, bad medical diagnosis, we can handle that. Somebody dies, we can handle that. Loss of income, we can handle that. The girl leaves us, the guy leaves us, we can handle that. Something we can point to and go, that's why I'm crazy. You know what we can't handle? When nothing's wrong, but we feel like something's wrong. We can't put our finger on it. We lay in bed at night and we think about our life and we go, I don't get it, man. I got money in the bank, everything's going good, I'm not drinking anymore, I'm back in my family's life. We just know there's something wrong and we can't put our finger on it. We go to meetings and people ask us, how you doing, Donnie? How you doing tonight? Good, good. Couldn't be doing any better. Any better, I'd go on a shooting spree. How are you? And we don't understand we're suffering from untreated alcoholism. And I suffered from that out there. And I've suffered from that in AA many times. And here's the problem with alcoholism. I never think that's what it is. I love that little line in the big book where it says, the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Though he usually doesn't think so should be everything that our sponsor ever's told us. Anything my sponsor's ever told me, I'm like, that's not it. My initial reaction to it is that he's not listening. That's not it. Well, Don, you're just being selfish. Nope, that's not it. That's not it. Don, you're an angry guy. I am not, you know, just, that's not it. So I drink and I drink and I drink and I do everything you read about in chapter 3, various vain attempts to control and enjoy my drinking, brief periods of recovery followed always by a still worse relapse. And I do that, and as I'm doing that, I'm spiraling. I'm spiraling down the drain. And I'm living what it talks about in the doctor's opinion. I'm getting drunk to get sober, to get drunk, to get sober, to get drunk, to get sober. And I take that irritable, restless, and discontent nature as long as I can in those brief periods of sobriety, and then I go on a spree, and I tear my life apart, and I tear your life apart. And then I can't take that anymore, and I emerge from that spree, what? Remorseful. Oh, my God, I did it again. God, I said I wouldn't do it again, and I did it again. I'm so sorry. And I have a firm resolve not to do it again. And it's repeated over and over again. And what Silkworth wrote is, unless I have an entire psychic change, that's going to happen till I die. And I got to tell you, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, this is how powerful AA is. I didn't come here to get sober. You know, I came here because I was in trouble. Imagine that. And before I came to AA, man, all the good was gone. You know what I mean? I'm not drinking to kid myself I'm better looking. I'm not drinking so I can ask a pretty girl to dance. I'm doing oblivion drinking. I'm a chronic alcoholic. I have to drink every day just to keep the wheels on the wagon. And I'm doing that light switch drinking where you get enough whiskey on board hard enough and fast enough to shut off your head so you can go into a blackout. And I'm living at my sister's house in Simi Valley, California, mooching a room off of them. And I'm waiting for the end. I'm drinking to die. And I thought it was going to end that way. And I got an unemployment check a couple of days before I got sober and went up to my brother-in-law, Larry, and said, Larry, got my unemployment check, can I borrow your car? And Larry asked me a funny question. He said, Don, will you be coming back this time? And I kind of borrowed his car a few times that summer and got on a little vacations. And our 12 and 12 says, as an alcoholic, my outstanding characteristic is defiance. So I got right in Larry's face. I said, Larry, how dare you? You know, the last time this happened, I apologized. And Larry, untreated Al-Anon that he was, felt terrible. And he took the keys out, and I snatched the keys from this man who I'm mooching a room off of to leave his house to get in his car. And I remember thinking, there better be gas in it. I went down to the liquor store to cash my unemployment check, because that's where guys like me cash them. And while I was in there, I had what the book refers to as the thought that precedes the first drink. And for me, that thought's always, what's in a half pint? Nobody ever got into trouble drinking a half pint of whiskey. And I got the half pint, and I drank that. It went so well, I drank another half pint. And I remember thinking, I can go visit those friends in the valley and be back in half an hour, and I am gone. 3 days later, I'm driving up the hill to face that family I'd done over one more time. One more time, I've taken their hope, their faith, and their trust, and I've torn it to shreds. You need to understand, driving up the hill to face that family I'd hurt one more time, I love them no less than I love them at this very moment. And I love my family tremendously. But I cannot serve two masters. I only got time to serve one, and that's King Alcohol. and you get between me and a drink, it's nothing personal. I'm getting to the drink. But when you don't know anything about alcoholism, you can't, and you don't know what you suffer from, and you're bringing a knife to a gunfight, you can't warn people. You can't say, look, I don't know what happened to me, but it keeps happening. I don't mean for this to go on, but it's going to happen again. I feel like I'm a puppet on the end of the strings. I feel like I'm possessed. You got to get away from me. You got to save yourself. But I don't know what I suffer from, so I can't warn you. So I say things like, I'm sorry. Man, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean for this to happen. Can you give me another chance? And this goes on year after year in my family and in my life, where I'm asking people for another chance, where I feel like I'm acting in a possessed manner, like I don't know how it keeps getting away from me. And I'm as surprised and baffled and confused as anybody that knows me and cares about me. I walk into a house that's been devastated by the disease of alcoholism to face the heat. And I find out there had been a big argument while I was gone. And my sister wanted to report, or my brother-in-law wanted to report the car stolen. And my sister negotiated him down to a missing persons report. And they've called the police, and now the police are on their way up to do the follow-up work. I got warrants for my arrest in two counties. So I start yelling at my sister, you know I got warrants. I'm going to jail. Thanks for nothing, because now it's her fault. I walk outside to wait for the police because I don't want the interview to go on in front of the family. I don't know what I'm going to be saying, but I know I'll be lying. You know what I mean? And I'm out there smoking a cigarette, and here comes the black and white up the hill. And on the side of the black and white, it says, canine unit. And I think, beautiful. They brought the dog. Like I'm in any shape to make a run for it. And with no prompting on my part, the cop got out, and he started asking me those hard, tough questions, like, where were you? And most of what I remember is illegal, so I'm lying to him, and he's not buying it, and I just want to divert his attention. And I point to the dog in the back seat, and I ask him, so that's your partner? And he walks over, and he opens the door, and this dog gets out, German Shepherd, not a hair out of place, like a Rin Tin Tin reincarnate. And he started suddenly relaying facts to me about the dog's life. The dog has passed mandatory retirement. They can't retire him. He's too good. The dog has participated in more arrests than any dog in the history of Ventura County. The dog has participated in more arrests and rescues than any dog in the history of Ventura or Los Angeles County. This dog was so amazing that the officers took a collection out of pocket to send him over to Europe for international competition, where he kicked butt on German Shepherds. So I said to the cop, I go, well, that's a phenomenal dog you have there, sir. And this little thought flew in the back of my mind, the kind of thought, the minute you think it, you know it's the truth. You want to deny it, but you know it's the truth. And what the truth was is this dog had done significantly more with his life than I'd done with mine. And I hated that dog. And I didn't know that was going to be my entrance into Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked back into that home that had been devastated by the disease, and they wanted me gone, and they have every reason to want me gone. But I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not too proud to beg, and I begged for another chance. I gave that Academy Award worthy performance, turned on the waterworks. I got nowhere to go. I'll die out there. I'm so sick. You got to give me another chance. Please, please, just a couple of days. I'll go to AA and everything. I have no idea why I said that. And it's not that my family believed I was going to go to AA. My sister, my first couple of nights here, drove me to AA and picked me up from AA. You know how it makes you feel when you look the way I look and you get in your older sister's car at the end of the night, all scrunched in, her 31-year-old loser brother, and she's driving back to her place saying, so, Donald, what'd you learn in AA tonight? It's just a bad look. It's just embarrassing. And I don't remember my first night in AA, but I remember my second night because the most important thing happened to me that I think happens in an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's more important than the format. I think it's more important than who's chairing, who's leading, who's speaking, any of the stuff, any of the minutiae that goes into a good AA meeting that we spend time at business meetings putting that together. We put all that stuff together so one thing and one thing only can happen. And if it didn't happen to me that night, you'd have another speaker. Because, you see, I'm on my second night of recovery, and I'd gone to the 6 o'clock meeting at the Simi Valley Alano Club. It was an hour and a half long, so now it's 7:30, and the 8 o'clock meeting is going to start, and I got my back against the wall, and I don't look that night the way I look this night. You know, I got hair down the middle of my back, and it's dirty. I got a full beard with food stuck in it. I've lost the ability to speak the King's English. I communicate in a series of hand gestures, grunts, and clicks. And I'm dying from alcoholism in the meeting of a clubhouse of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm looking at the good members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm wearing my sunglasses at night, and I got my arms folded, and I'm rocking back and forth. And I'm not rocking back and forth because I'm a tough guy. I'm rocking back and forth because I feel like I'm going to explode from the inside out because I'm detoxing hard in this clubhouse. And the good men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous are giving me a wide berth because I am dangerous, because I'm terrified. And anybody terrified is dangerous. And I'm looking at the good members of Alcoholics Anonymous and your clean clothes and your smiles and your laughter, and you all seem to know each other, and you all seem to have gone to school together, and you all seem to live together, and you're not talking to me, and this head starts talking to me, the committee starts talking to me about what am I doing in AA. Look at them, Don, they're clean and they're friendly and they like each other, and they're not talking to you. You know why they're not talking to you? Because they don't want any part of you. You know what, Don, you're a loser and you smell bad and you look bad. Why would anybody want you here? And you know, you do this to us all the time, Don. You're going to quit drinking. You're going to quit drinking. Then what do? You take it for what? 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, a week, a month. And then what do? You drink again. You put us through all that pain, and then you drink anyway. You know, here's an idea for you, Slick. Why don't you go get a drink right now? Why don't you just knock off this baloney? Oh, you've come to AA. That's going to be different. Come on. Who are you kidding? You're going to drink again. You always drink again. Let's get out of here, and let's get a drink. And every molecule in my body is screaming to go get another drink of alcohol. And I have no effective mental defense against the first drink. I'm a chronic alcoholic, and I got to leave you. Because I can't take the pain of sobriety one more second. And I caught a break. Because over in the corner were two card-carrying members of Alcoholics Anonymous named Lou and Mark. And the way they tell the story is they saw me. And Mark looked at Lou and said, "Whoa." And Lou looked at Mark and said, "Yeah." And Mark said, "I bet we can't get him sober." And Lou said, "Well, we are here anyway." And then they took the most important action that I see taken in Alcoholics Anonymous. Two card-carrying members of AA took a 30-foot journey across an AA clubhouse to cordially welcome a man who was dying from the disease of alcoholism. "Hi, my name is Lou. This is Mark. We don't think we've met you. Why don't you come sit with us?" It sounds like such a politeness, such a nicety. Why do I think it's so important? You expect me with 2 days of sobriety to go say hi to them? I can't make it. 30 feet for them, it's a million miles for me. No, they understood that they would have to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. All that was required of me was to receive it. And I sat down on the table with Mark, and Lou continued to stand, and they got me a half a cup of coffee, and Lou clapped me on the back and said, "Don, this is Mark. He's going to be your sponsor." He walked away. And they assigned me my first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that's not done everywhere. It's not done most places. But in my case, it was probably a good idea. Because we say things in AA that we've been saying for so long, I don't even think we think about them. Every meeting I go to, in the format somewhere, they stress the importance of sponsorship. Get a sponsor, get a sponsor, get a sponsor. And my favorite thing we say to our new friends, find somebody that has what you want. Huh. I wonder what I want my second night of sobriety. Oh, I don't know, maybe a pharmaceutical rep with a spare Cadillac? It's a beginning, because I'd have never picked the weenie boy they assigned to me, you know what I mean? He's nothing like me. I mean, he's slight of frame, bald of head, wire-rimmed glasses, soft-spoken, and whoo, he loves God. I hear people saying, "Hey, I don't hit the new man or woman with the God talk till they get their feet underneath them." He didn't get that memo. In our first meeting, he was talking about God, what God did for him, what God did for them, what God did for you. And he was expecting a miracle. He was on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I recall, without my permission, I might add, he got a meeting directory and he started telling me the meetings I'd be going to in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason I know this is he said, "These are the meetings you'll be going to in Alcoholics Anonymous." And he's circling these meetings. And I remember thinking, that's an awful lot of circling. And while he's circling in this directory, he's telling me about AA, telling me about God, telling me about his sponsor. Then he stops and he goes, "Are you working?" "Well, no, I'm currently unemployed." More circling, and gets me a big book, 12 and 12, hands me the meeting directory, and then he insults me. Because if you're going to sponsor new people, you want to get off on the right foot, I guess, and insult them as soon as possible. And he says, "Do you think you can go home tonight and not drink?" That's just rude, isn't it? I mean, I'm coming up on 48 hours of sobriety. It's just rude. And it upset me. And I said, listen, fella, any idiot can go a day without drinking. And he lit up like Christmas. He said, oh, you're going to be perfect for our program. I got in my sister's car that night with all these books, and she said, oh, my goodness. I said, I know. I think I got homework. And it began. And I didn't know this at that moment, but I had a sponsor. And I had a home group because he had a home group. And I had a list of meetings I'd be attending. I didn't understand that on my second night of sobriety, I'd been handed the keys to the kingdom. I had the building blocks of sobriety. And all I had to do was keep coming back. That simple thing that we tell new people, keep coming back. All I had to do was come back the next night, and the journey would continue. And this sponsor, man, he made it easy on me my first 30 days or so. You know what I mean? He didn't care about my big problems. And I had big problems, you know? And I'm wearing them out, talking about my big problems. And it's like, man, I'm 80 grand in debt to the IRS. I haven't worked in a year. I got warrants for my arrest in two counties. I don't have a car. I live at my sister's house. I've never had a checking account. I'm not just an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic slash loser, man. I'm a Baden fever. And I'm telling him about this stuff because I'm sobering up. And when I sober up, I can't keep all that stuff down with all that whiskey, and it's starting to float to the top and choke me out. And I can't take the way I'm feeling. And I'm telling him how bad I feel about these things in my life. He goes, oh, these are your problems. I go, yeah, I think they're fairly significant. He goes, you're wrong. Those are wrong. It's situational stuff. You know, you show up in AA, you take some direction, that stuff takes care of itself. Listen, you only got one problem. I'll keep it simple for a guy like you. You got something called alcoholism, which means it wants to kill you slowly and take a large bite out of anyone that has the misfortune of caring about a guy like you. And we'll let you know when these other things are a problem. And what I heard was I didn't have to pay back the IRS. Found out I was wrong. My first 30 days in sobriety, man, he had it easy on me. He took it easy on me. He didn't care about nothing. He just wanted me at the meeting. Those two meetings a night at the Simi Valley Alano Club. He wanted me to have a job at those meetings. A little commitment, he called them. He goes, there's no hired help. We don't sub anything out in AA. There's no referrals from AA, and we don't sub anything out, man. This is the last house on the block. That's true, man. Think about that. We don't refer anybody. Like, if you can't make it in AA, you walk up to someone in AA and go, you know, AA isn't really for me. Where do you think I should go? We don't know where to send you. There are no referrals from AA. You are on the last house on the block. Nobody gets here easy. Nobody gets here on a winning streak. And so he just wanted me to have a commitment because he said, we're for free and for fun, but we do it by ourselves. You know, we do everything. So I had a little job at every meeting. And I thought it was like slave labor, you know, because I noticed not all the old timers had jobs. I'm this new guy. I'm crazy. I'm going to two meetings a night. I'm setting up. I'm cleaning out, putting out literature, washing coffee cups, picking up cigarette butts. But I notice, because I'm only like 6-7 days sober, man, and my alcoholism returned my rights. You know what I mean? So I'm looking around at what's wrong with AA. I didn't need to be sober long, man. I mean, I'm the kind of guy, I can, like, judge you from the gutter. You know what I mean? I can lay in the gutter, and as you walk by, I'll go, where'd you get those ugly shoes? You know, it's not a problem. And I did it in AA brand new. Notice people weren't doing as much as me. Went to my sponsor. I said, I have noticed that some people around here are not doing as much as I am. Perhaps you would care to explain that to me. And he just looked at me and said, some are sicker than others, and walked away. That was his explanation. I was sober 6 months before I figured out that's not a compliment. Because the first time he said it to me, I was complimented. That's right, that's right. And I am one of them, you know. Jesus, I was torqued down. But I'm going to AA every night, man. And I get 30 days, and there's stuff going on in my life, huge spiritual things in my life, but I'm self-obsessed, and I'm new in AA, so I'm missing it, right? I don't even see it. The hand of God is in my life. He has reached into the abyss. He has pulled me out of the abyss. I've landed in AA safe and sane to a degree, and I'm sober, and I'm surrounded by love and comfort and fellowship, and I'm missing it because I'm so crazy, because I've been so reliant on alcohol for so long to everything in my life that being sober felt shocking, felt abnormal. I felt naked and exposed and embarrassed constantly. I can't sleep at night. I'm haunted by the memories of what I've done and who I've hurt. I sit in AA tired, trying not to fall asleep in the second meeting when old timers are elbowing you so you don't fall asleep, and you're thinking, man, I just want to go home and get some sleep. and you lay down when you're new and you try to go to sleep and it's the Don Landis Film Festival all night. God, I thought I forgot that. Oh, I remember when I did that. Ah, oh, fifth grade. And you just toss and turn and you can't sleep. And you think it's always going to be that way because I'm not drinking. And I'm not doing any of that other crap. I'm sober for the first time in forever. And I've gotten off the train. But the train doesn't leave the station, and King Alcohol doesn't give up one of his subjects easily. And if I'm not drinking and I'm not doing that other crap, how's my disease going to get me? How's it going to make runs at me? Big Book tells me the main problem of the alcoholic exists in his mind rather than his body. It's where my disease lives, and it has my body for transportation and all the time in the world to get to me. And the way my disease makes runs at me is it whispers things in my voice in my head that appear to be the truth. They seem real to me when I think them. And when I feel so bad early in sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, this is what my head tells me. It's always going to feel this way. And I got to tell you, if that's true, then what's the point of staying in a joint like Alcoholics Anonymous? If I'm going to feel terrible for the rest of my life, I might as well be drunk or I might as well be dead. And I know there's people here tonight that are new in sobriety that are struggling. Yeah, you're sober, and yeah, you're glad you're in A, but you don't feel great yet. And you don't feel good, and your head talks to you a lot. And maybe you still want to drink, and maybe you still want to do that other stuff, and you're afraid to talk about it because you think you're doing something wrong. And I got to tell you, you're not doing anything wrong. Maybe you haven't been here long enough to do enough right. Give yourself a break. Hang out in AA. Hang out with us. Talk to the people with time. I'm not talking. Talk to people with 10 years and 15 years and 20 years that seem to be happy, that are moving fast, and ask them how they did it. And ask them this. Go, hey, man, did it suck when you were new? And then get comfortable, because they're going to give you a 10-minute dissertation about how horrible it was when they were new, when they had to walk the meetings in the snow uphill both ways, when they only had one big book to share. Because it was harder then, trust me, you know. But hang in there, newcomer, because your disease is a liar, man. And the biggest lie my disease ever told me was that whopper. I was always going to feel that way. And I'm glad I stuck around long enough for things to change and find out that was a lie. And it doesn't matter that my life has changed and things are wonderful in my life. I miss it all. I mean, I'm going to AA all night, and I'm getting sober in my family's home. The very family I had destroyed with my drinking, they love me enough that they're giving me a chance to get sober in their house. Isn't that something? And I got no gratitude for it, because I'm self-obsessed with my trouble and my problems, that I don't even understand how spiritual it is that they've turned the other cheek and they're giving me one more chance. And I come home. You know how it is in AA. And I got a sister. She's a professional, man. She's a psychologist. She gets up early and she works hard all day. Right? And I'm so self-obsessed, I don't even notice she's staying up till I get home from AA because she wants to hear about what happened to her brother in AA that night. Isn't that something? Man, you know how it is in AA, man. You go to two meetings at night when you're new. That second meeting ends at 9:30, and then you clean up, and it's 10 o'clock at night, and you're ready to go home, and somebody goes, hey, you want to go out for coffee? And you go, coffee? Coffee sounds good. I'd like to have another cup of coffee. I've only had 15 cups of coffee tonight. Another cup? Well, it sounds good. Yeah, it sounds good. Double espresso sounds good right now. And then you go to your sponsor, you go, I can't sleep at night, I don't know what it is. And I think it's remorse. More likely it's caffeine, not remorse. But my sister would ask me questions about AA, and I would tell her what was going on, and I told her about AA in Southern California. I said, yeah, if you stay sober 30 days, they'll give you a little token. They call it a chip, a little colored hunk of aluminum, and they do that at 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, 6 months, and 9 months. And if you're lucky enough to stay sober a year, they'll bake you a cake. And they'll sing happy birthday to you. It's the most disgusting thing you've ever seen. Until it happens to you, then it's kind of cool. And I tell my sister about AA, man. I remember I got 30 days in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. 30 continuous days. Nothing that affects me from the neck up. And I went to my regular meeting that night. And I walked in and everybody in that room was grinning at me. And I realized in that moment that everyone in that room had been counting days with me. And they asked if anybody had 30 days, man. I raised my hand and everybody applauded. And I was embarrassed. And I didn't want you to see me. And I want you to know how much it meant to me. And I was so afraid to hope, to dare the hope that I had found something. Because I'm a loser, man. I'm a guy that always drinks. Let's all calm down. It's only 30 days. But you were so encouraging. And I got that little hunk of colored aluminum, man, and I put it between my thumb and forefinger. I slid it in my pocket, and I sat back in my chair. And I'm trying to look cool, and the tears are welling up in my eye, and I can't figure out why this stupid colored hunk of aluminum, after I've been some places, I've done some things in my life, I've accomplished some things, and this little piece, this little trinket, means more to me than all of it. And I walk home, I get dropped off by my sponsor that night, and he says, do it again, you know. And I walk into a home that's been devastated by the disease of alcoholism, and I close the door, and I turn around, my sister comes around the corner, and she's got a cupcake, and there's a candle in it. And the candle's lit, and she's singing happy birthday to me. And she gets done with the song, and she lets me blow out the candle, and she says, look, my brother, I know you don't get a real cake till you're a year sober, but for you, 30 days is like a year. And I even missed what was going on there. This is amazing. Now, here's a woman that had never been to Alcoholics Anonymous, never been to Al-Anon, never read in the AA literature, never read in the Al-Anon literature. Yet there's a part in the book that says, when men and women come to Alcoholics Anonymous, there's something about the energy in the place, the electricity, the light in the eyes of the people that let the sufferer know that maybe they found haven at last. And I'm of the belief that when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, the God that runs AA attaches himself to us. And when we return to our respective homes, occupations, and affairs, whether our family members and our employers and our friends come to AA or Al-Anon or not, there's something about us that lets them know that maybe they found safe haven at last. Maybe my family was going to be okay. Maybe my family was going to be safe because of what was happening to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was just amazing. I just missed that whole thing. And I had a sponsor, man. He was great. He was kind of like one of those Yoda ninja warriors. You know what I mean? Like really spiritual and really, you know, mystical. And you look in the mirror, there lies the problem. You know, and the... And he's always, he was a really nice guy, but every now and then he was like that ninja. He would just slide the blade in. You know what I mean? You wouldn't even feel it go in. I think I've been stabbed. And he would just come at me with stuff. And I remember being, God, I was maybe 3 months sober. And he came up to me and he said, you got the day off tomorrow, right? And I said, yeah. And he goes, great, let's go to court. And I said, who are we going for? Because I've been in court a lot. We go to court in AA, you know what I mean? We're always going to court to support somebody, stand up for somebody, wave goodbye to somebody. I mean, we go to court in AA. So I said to him, who are we going for? He goes, going for? We're going for you. I said, the perfect newcomer response. I said, me? They don't even know where I'm at. And he said something stupid like, if I wanted to live free, I had to live free of my wreckage. And I said, man, I'm not even on the ninth step. And he goes, yeah, I know. For you, we're going to make an exception. And I'm trying to figure out what I did to piss my sponsor off. Because I've done everything he's asked me. He's going to throw me to the wolves. So I go to bed that night. I don't sleep at all. 8 o'clock the next morning, man, he pulls up in front of my sister's house. I go out in the car. He's in the best mood I've ever seen him in. I mean, he's grinning at me. He's whistling. We're driving down the court. And at one point, he turned to me and he said, Don, let me explain something to you. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in a great deal of trouble. Now you're in trouble. I got to tell you, this is better. You know, we go into court, and I get my name in the docket, and I wait for my name to be called, and the judge rustles the paperwork and tells me, you're late. 4 years, you know. And I just, you know, I'm even in that situation, I'm removed by sponsor direction because I just told them what my sponsor said to say. And I didn't skate. I didn't get away with anything. I had to pay back a lot of money. I had to do an obscene amount of community service. I did so much community service at the Salvation Army in Simi Valley that when I was done, they threw me a party, you know. But you know what? I walked into that situation knowing I was going to go to jail, and I walked out a free man with society had given me a plan to follow. And they said, if you follow this plan, we're going to call it even. And the truth is, society has always been kind to me. They've always given me a chance to make it right. I've just never followed through. But I had some stuff going for me. I had a relationship with God, although it was new. I had a relationship with a sponsor, although it was new. I had a membership in Alcoholics Anonymous, although it was new. And those things seemed to make the difference. I was able to follow through on stuff, and I got out of that trouble. And more importantly, I learned maybe I don't know everything about everything. And what it did is it created some teachability in me. And my sponsor would just keep teaching me these weird lessons in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was like 4 months sober, and he comes up to me, and just after a meeting, he goes, listen, what are you doing for your family to say thank you for them letting you get sober in their house? And I hadn't even thought about it. I said, well, I'm not drinking. And he said, yeah, that's mighty big of you. go home tonight and ask your sister if there's anything you can do. I'm, okay, fine. So I go home and I find my sister and I go, listen, my sponsor wants to know. And she loved my sponsor. Because I made the mistake once of saying that he was occasionally mean to me. And she just loved that. She goes, oh, he's mean to you? Oh, that's great. I said, yeah, he called me a little boy in a man's body. Oh, that's beautiful. What else does he say? She, the meaner my sponsor was, the more she liked him, right? So I go, is there anything I can do? And she doesn't miss a beat. She goes, well, you can paint my house. And I said, your whole house? And I said, well, I got to talk to my sponsor. So I found my sponsor the next night, and I said, listen, this crazy woman wants me to paint her two-story, 3,800-square-foot house. And he goes, is she buying the paint? And I go, I assume. And he goes, ah, you got off easy. Paint her house. And he walks away real dismissively. He used to do this. He used to piss me off. He'd get the last word, and then I'd watch his bald head just going off in the distance. And I remember I yelled at his bald head. I said, hey, I thought this program was suggested. That was a mistake. Because I didn't know he could move like that. You know, he was like back in my personal space immediately, and he's looking up at me, and I'm looking down on him, and he's, listen, Don, you're so sick that anything that I tell you, we're going to assume it's a direction, and we'll let you know when you've passed into the suggestion phase of the program. And so now I'm painting her house, man. And if you would ask me going into that why I'm doing it, I said, this is what happens when you're a craphead brother and you make the mistake of joining an outfit like Alcoholics Anonymous. You end up painting somebody's house for free. And I would have been wrong. Because I'll never know for sure what it did for my sister. But I know this for me. The longer I was into that project, the more I was able to be in the same room with my sister at the same time, breathing the same air. And that wall that my drinking and the behavior that I brought into that family had created, that wall started to go down a little bit. And when I got done painting her house, man, she told me it caused a great healing in her life. And we weren't even or Steven or anything, but I could be in the same room at the same time with my sister. And AA, through the actions and dictates of a sponsor, gave me back one of the most important people in my life, which is my older sister, Pat. And I got to tell you, a few years ago, man, I had the honor and privilege of going to Iceland and speaking in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I told my sister I was going to Iceland. And immediately she's like, I want to go to Iceland. And my sister went with three other AA members and herself, and we went all over Iceland and carried the message. And she's not an AA. She just tagged along on her own dime. She likes hanging out with her brother, and she likes what AA looks like. And she likes to be in the room and watch what we're like when we're with each other. You know, she's a psychologist for a living, and she's a very, very smart woman with a big brain. And she goes, it's the purest example of love she's ever seen is what happens in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she likes to be around it and witness it. And she knows what it's done for her brother. So I thank AA for giving me back my family. And, you know, things go on. You know, you work through the steps and you have that psychic change. And you make those amends, you know. And some of the amends are easy and some of them are tough. You know, some of them we go to our family members that have watched us get sober. And we kind of know they approve of what we're doing. And those are the easy amends. It's the ones we haven't seen people in a while. And we don't know if they're going to throw us out of their office. And we have that fear associated with it. And we construct a story that maybe it's okay. Maybe I don't have to make that amends. Maybe we can let bygones be bygones. And I had an employer like that. I had a guy, man, he was like a father to me. You know what I mean? And I was raised without a dad. My dad deserted the family when I was 2 years old, and I haven't seen him since. And this guy was like a surrogate father, man. When I was young, he took me into work, gave me a career, paid me way more than I, gave me opportunities. And all I did as my alcoholism progressed is I left that company, took some of his biggest clients, and went to a competitor. How do you make something like that right? And I didn't want to make amends to this guy. The idea of facing him just scared the hell out of me. And one day I was walking through one of the big malls in Southern California, man, and wouldn't you know it, I see him walking right at me. And I didn't even have time to think. It's like there he was 50 yards away, and I just panicked, and I just ran into the closest storefront, and I hid like a scared little boy. And as I was looking out past the mannequin in the window, he walks by, and it's not him. And I look around, and I'm hiding in a Victoria's Secret store with a lot of very uncomfortable women looking at me. And I realized at that moment that I'd rather make the amends than live in that kind of fear. You know, and interestingly enough, that amends did not go well. And he didn't throw me out of his office, but he let me know in no uncertain terms that since our relationship, he never went full boat with anybody he ever employed again. He goes, today, employees are employees. They used to be family until I met you. Until you did what you did to me, I always thought people were good. After that, it's business only. I've never trusted anybody again. So you got to thank yourself for that. Now get out of my office. And that's how that amends went. They're not always happy stories, but like the book says, it's water over the dam. I've made my demonstration. And I owed a lot of money. I owed the IRS 80 grand. And I got to tell you, my first couple of years in sobriety, I was making minimum wage with taxes taken out. You know what I mean? I had one of those sponsors who didn't want me to go back in the industry I was from. He used to say, no, you'll make the big money, then your ego won't be smashed, and then you'll drink and die, and it doesn't matter. He got me a job. He found out I'd never work with my hands, and he got me a job as a laborer on a framing crew. That was my first job in sobriety. Well, I'd love to tell you, I found out my life's calling was to work with my hands. I'd be lying. I sucked at that job. I was terrible at that job. I had a nickname on the job site, the bleeder, you know? And I mean, if you owe the IRS 80 grand and you got a million in the bank, it might sting a little bit. But if you got no car, no job, no prospects, you're making minimum wage and you got a sponsor going, don't worry, kid, they don't want your money. They don't. No, they want their money, you know? And everybody in AA is telling you, call them up. It'll be okay. You know why we can do that? You know why I can do it? You know why sponsors can tell you to pay back that money, show up in court, give that guy, because it's not their money. It's not their court. They're not going to jail. It's easy to tell a guy to go to court. I'm not going to jail, but it'll be good for you, you know? It'll all be over soon. God, man, I remember calling the IRS up and entering into a payment agreement with them, man. I'm going to send them $100 a month. That won't even cover the penalties and interest that's being added on every month. But I got to start somewhere. That's what they told me in AA. And I remember writing them the first check for $100, thinking to myself, oh, good, $79,900 to go. And I asked my sponsor, when am I going to feel better about this? And he said, I don't know, Don, someday. And a funny thing happened, though. The minute I started paying back the IRS, I started getting better jobs. I started making more money. Now, I didn't have any more money. I just had more money to send the IRS. But I noticed it was almost like I stood up behind the hedge of life, stopped hiding. The universe saw that. And suddenly, once I started making the amends, the money was there to continue it. I didn't have the money part figured out until I made the action. And then the book says God's everything or else he's nothing. My experience is when I took the action, things started to happen in my life. And I got married in sobriety. I met a girl early on, and we got married. I was 5 years sober. She was 4 years sober. Boy meets girl on AA campus, my beautiful bride, Eileen. And we started this walk together, and we got an AA house today. You know what I mean? Somebody's always coming across the threshold for something. Step work or just a shoulder to cry on or just hanging out with us. And we sponsor a lot of people, and we're having a very good time in Bellingham, Washington. And I got to tell you, I mean, that was a real culture shock from us. We were both in the Pacific Group in Los Angeles for over a decade, very large group, very structured, and suddenly we're in very much smaller AA than we're used to. And it was good. There's nothing wrong with the AA in Bellingham. In fact, it's excellent, but it was different than what we knew. And we also knew to shut up and try to fit in because we needed them. They didn't need us. And, Pam and Steve were here, saw us when we moved to Bellingham, you know. Their home group in Bellingham was my first home group. And they were like good AA members waiting for us in Bellingham. But it was still tough. It was because we're city kids, you know what I mean? We're from L.A. And we're concrete, steel, and glass. And suddenly, we're 8 miles out of town by the lake, and it's dark at night, you know what I mean? It's like darkity dark dark. I mean, I remember the first time I ever forgot something in the car and I didn't have the porch light on and I didn't have a flashlight. And I got halfway to the car and a little voice in my head said, Cougar. And I just jumped up and ran in the house and slammed the door and I'm like this. And Eileen's like, what's with you? And I'm like, don't go out there. Darkity dark dark. Because we're city kids, man. We were out in the county and they have these beautiful dairy farms out in the county. Just really like postcards, man. Beautiful cow. And we're driving in the county one day after when we moved out there. And we just, because we didn't have farmland where I lived. Right? So that's beautiful to us. The mountains and the farmland. Like, this is gorgeous. And look, there's cows. And we're driving along. There's this one Jersey cow right on the fence. Beautiful Jersey cow. And Eileen goes, stop the car. Stop the car. I stop the car. And she jumps out of the car. She's standing in the middle of a two-lane road taking a picture of this Jersey cow. And about this time, this old farmer comes up in a pickup. Bum, 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 bum. She sees him coming. She gets out of the way. And he stops right next to my wife and rolls down the window. My wife goes, oh, I'm sorry, was I in your wedding? He goes, no, no, can I ask you something? She goes, sure. And he goes, you do know it's a cow. And she says, uh-huh. And he goes, just checking. Drives off. So we're city kids, man. And my favorite story from that transition, I think, sums up what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we were there, and there's a lot of wildlife where we live, a lot of raccoon and possum and deer. We got a lot of deer. I mean, so we moved there. We got deer in our backyard every day, and I was freaking out. Oh, my God, we got deer. And then the mama deer start showing up in the summer with their spotted fawns, and we freaked out. We got baby deer in our backyard. If you need 20,000 digital photographs of a baby deer, I got them. You know what I mean? So we're just geeking out on these baby deer, and I fell in love with this one little baby boy deer because he had a big scratch across his face, this big scar. So I had a story in my head, like he got into one of the bucks and tried to defend his mom's honor and got beat up, something, you know. And we're city kids, so we're naming the deer. That's Mama Deer and Scratch, Mama Deer and Scratch, you know. And then rutting season in the fall comes, right, and the deer start taking off their winter coats and they start putting on their summer coats and they start putting on their winter coats, but not Scratch. You know, Scratch is like, he's starting to look, for lack of a better word, ugly. You know, he's getting big patches of missing fur in his body. And I noticed that, like, what's with Scratch? He's just not looking right. And my wife agrees with me, and she's like that girl, man. So she gets on the internet, she researches it, and it turns out it's an actual affliction. It's called deer hair loss syndrome. And if they lose enough of their fur, winter will come. And they won't be able to eat enough to keep their furnace going. And they'll get hypothermic, and they'll die. And I said, Scratch is going to die? And she goes, yeah. And I go, not on our watch. And we lost our mind. And we started breaking every wildlife management law in the state of Washington. My wife starts setting up supplemental feeding stations in the backyard, and that is way illegal. And here's the other thing. When you got one sick deer you want to feed, you can't feed the one sick deer. So we got 20, 30 deer coming from all over in our backyard, and they're chasing the babies out. They're chasing the sick one out. And my wife's not having it, man. She's out there with 150-pound bucks yelling at them, you're selfish, you're self-centered, get out of here. It's bananas, man. And it's not working. He's looking worse, man. And I would go, now it's wintertime, and I'm obsessed with this baby deer. And I'd go to work and call my wife at noon and go, have you seen Scratch today? And she'd go, yeah, he came by. I go, how's he doing? She goes, not good. And I'd shake my fist at God and get angry. Not this one, God. You don't get this one. And now the poor deer has lost all the fur on his body, and all he's got left is about a 3-inch wide, 3-inch high swatch of fur from the nape of his neck all the way down to his rump. And we've overfed him so much, and now he's rounded out like a beer keg. So now he just sits in our backyard in the winter, this fat, ugly mohawk newcomer deer just eating and pooping, and I'm obsessed with this deer, obsessed with him. And springtime comes, and he makes it to spring and doesn't die. And for the next 3 or 4 years, every rutting season in the fall, he would show up in our backyard, and we knew it was him because of the scar. And he'd be this beautiful buck with this huge rack, and he'd walk right up to Eileen, and Eileen could feed him apples by hand. And I'd watch that scene, and I'd think to myself, what was it about that damn deer that made me lose my mind? And one day it hit me. I'm that baby deer. I'm that guy sitting in the Simi Valley Alano Club with anyone that had a glancing familiarity with alcoholism would have taken one look at me and said, that guy over there, he's going to die. And 2 card-carrying members of Alcoholics Anonymous saw the exact same thing and said, oh, not on our watch. And I got to tell you, I believe this as much as I believe anything. It's our watch now. And I know that why we're here this weekend, we're going to have a good time. But right outside in the streets of our respective home groups, they are dying. And here's the funny part. They're coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they don't even know it yet. But we do. We know they're running out their string. They're running out their game. They're running out of plan Bs. And eventually, they're going to show up in our respective home groups. And the question we have to ask ourselves, when they show up in AA, where will we be? And more importantly, how will we be? I mean, am I going to be at my home group cutting up with my buddies, talking about business, talking about the football, talking about fishing, talking about this? Or am I going to be like Lou and Mark, like I was taught, with my eyes trained on the room, my eyes trained on the door? You know, it's just another night for me in AA, but that could be somebody's last night. Am I going to be on the ready? But I got to tell you, I have to spiritually prepare to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I come to AA after a day of work or a day of whatever, and I got the world hanging on me. I got my money hanging on me. I got my marriage hanging on me. I got things I want to do hanging on me. I got my hobbies hanging on me. I got the gifts of sobriety hanging on me. I'm distracted. And I shut down my rig, and I don't get out before I say a prayer. And I say the same prayer. God, I'm at Alcoholics Anonymous right now. Let me leave my worldly concerns and all my problems in the front seat with you. I know you'll take care of them. Let me go in there and remember there's men there that need to be told that this thing works, that need to have their hands shaken, that need to be cordially welcomed to AA. Let me go for just the next hour and a half and let me be a servant. And now I'm ready to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I'm ready to walk in. Now I've got eyes. I'm looking for the new guys. Make sure I don't know that guy. Introduce myself. Those small niceties, the politeness that saved my life when I was new. Because when I don't do that, I can walk in and go right to my buddies and start talking about what's going on in their life and walk right by a new guy. And that's not the AA I want, man. I want the AA that's all-inclusive. I want the AA that saved my life. I want the AA that when I walked in, the hand of God working through another alcoholic reached into that abyss and pulled me to safety. I want that kind of AA. For that, I'm responsible. I want to thank you so much for listening tonight. I'm all done.